Chapter 22. The End of a Legend. At night, Gawain couldn't see the White Tower's wounds. In darkness, one couldn't tell the difference between a beautifully intricate mural and a wall full of mismatched tiles. At night, the most beautiful of Tar Valon's buildings became another dark lump. And at night, the holes and scars on the White Tower were patched with a bandage of darkness. Of course, on a night as dark as these clouds cause, one also couldn't tell the tower's color, white or black. At night, it didn't really matter. Gawain walked the White Tower grounds, wearing stiff trousers and coat of red and gold. Like a uniform, but of no specific allegiance. He didn't seem to have a specific allegiance these days. Almost unconsciously, he found himself walking toward the eastern tower entrance as if to climb up to Egwene's sleeping chambers. He set his jaw, turning the other way. He should have been sleeping, but after nearly a week of guarding Egwene's door at night, he was, as soldiers like to say, on a midnight lunch. Perhaps he could have stayed in his rooms to relax, but his quarters in the White Tower's barracks felt confining. Nearby, two small feral cats stalked through tufts of grass, eyes reflecting the torchlight of a guard post. The cats hunkered low, watching him as if considering, for a brief moment, whether or not he'd be worth attacking. An unseen owl cruised in the air above, the only evidence of its passing a solitary feather that floated down. It was easier to pretend at night. Some men lived their entire lives that way, preferring the curtains of darkness to the open windows of daylight, because they let them see the world all in shadow. It was summer now, but though the day had been hot, the night was strangely cold. He shivered at a passing breeze. There hadn't been any murders since the death of that unfortunate wight. When would the killer strike again? He, or she, could be moving through the hallways at this moment, searching for a solitary Aes Sedai, as those cats searched for mice. Egwene had sent him away from her door, but that didn't mean he couldn't be on the watch. What good was it to walk the grounds? He should be indoors, where he had a chance of doing some good. Gawain made his way to one of the servant entrances. The low-ceilinged hallway inside was clean and well-lit, like the rest of the tower, though the floor was set with dull gray slate instead of glazed tiles. An open room to his right resounded with laughter and chatting, off-duty guardsmen enjoying time with their comrades. Gawain gave them barely a glance, but then froze. He looked back in, recognizing some of the men.
"Mazon, Selark, Zhang, what are you men about?"
The three looked up with alarm, then chagrin. They were among about a dozen younglings who were dicing and smoking pipes with the off-duty tower guardsmen. The younglings stumbled to their feet and gave salutes, though he was no longer their commander. They didn't seem to realize that. Selark, foremost among them, hastened over to Gawain. He was a lean fellow, with light brown hair and thick fingers.
"My lord," he said. "Nothing important, my lord. Just a little harmless fun."
"The warders don't like this kind of behavior," Gawain said. "You know that, Selark. If it gets round that you're staying up this late dicing, you'll never convince an Aes Sedai to take you."
Selark grimaced.
"Yes, my lord."
There was something reluctant in that grimace.
"What?" Gawain said.
"Out with it, man."
"Well, my lord," Selark said. "It's that some of us, we aren't so sure that we want to be warders. Not all of us came here for that, you know. Some were like you, wanting to train with the best. And the rest of us, well, things have changed now."
"What things?" Gawain asked.
"Foolish things, my lord," the man said, looking down. "You're right, of course. There's early sparring tomorrow. But, well, we've seen war. We're soldiers now. Being a warder, it's all a man should aspire to. But some of us, We'd rather not see what we have no end, you know?
Gawain nodded slowly.
When I first came to the tower, Salark said, I wanted nothing more than to be a warder. Now I don't know that I want to spend my life protecting one woman, solitary, roving about the countryside.
You could be a warder to a brown or white, Gawain said, and stay in the tower. Salark frowned.
With all respect, my lord, I think that might be just as bad. Warders, they don't live like other men.
That's for certain, Gawain said, eyes lifting upward toward Egwene's distant quarters. He would not go seeking that door. He forced his gaze back down to Salark.
There's no shame in choosing a different path. The others make it sound like there is.
The others are wrong, Gawain said. Gather those of you who want to remain with the younglings and report to Captain Chubane tomorrow. I'll speak with him. I'll wager he could use you as a division in the Tower Guard. He lost a lot of men in the Seanchan attack.
Salark relaxed visibly.
You'd do that, my lord?
Of course. It was an honor to lead you men.
Do you think maybe you could join with us?
The youth's voice was hopeful. Gawain shook his head.
I've another path to take. But, the light willing, I'll end up close enough to keep an eye on you.
He nodded toward the room.
Go back to your games. I'll speak to Maxim for you as well.
Maxim was the stern, thick-armed warder currently leading the training sessions. Salark nodded gratefully, hurrying back to the others. Gawain continued down the corridor, wishing his choices were as easy as those of his men. Lost in thought, he'd climbed halfway to Egwene's rooms before he stopped to realize what he was doing.
I need something to distract me.
The hour wasn't too late. Perhaps he could find Bryn and chat. Gawain made his way to Bryn's rooms. If Gawain had a strange position among the Aes Sedai, Bryn's was nearly as odd. Warder to the former Ammerlin, general of Egwene's conquering army, and renowned great captain. Bryn's door was cracked, emitting a line of light across the blue-tiled corridor. That was his habit when he was in and awake, should one of his officers need him. Many nights Bryn was away, staying at one of his command centers around the island or in a nearby village. Gawain knocked softly.
Come.
Bryn's voice was firm and familiar. Gawain slipped in, then returned the door to its cracked position. Bryn sat at a rickety-looking desk, working on a letter. He glanced at Gawain.
Just a moment.
Gawain waited. The walls were papered with maps of Tarvalen, Andor, Kyrian, and surrounding regions. Many bore recent notations in red chalk. Bryn was preparing for war. The notations made it clear he felt he'd eventually have to defend Tarvalen itself against Trollocs. Several maps showed villages across the northern part of the countryside, listing their fortifications, if any, and their loyalty to Tarvalen. They'd be used for supply dumps and forward positions. Another map had circles pointing out ancient watchtowers, fortifications, and ruins. There was a methodical inevitability to Bryn's calculations, and a sense of urgency. He wasn't looking to build fortifications, but to use those already in place. He was moving troops into the villages he felt most useful. Another map showed progress in active recruitment. It wasn't until Gawain stood there, smelling the musty scent of old paper and burning candles, that he felt the reality of the impending war. It was coming soon. The dragon would break the seals of the Dark One's prison. The place he had told Egwene to meet him, the Field of Merilor, was marked in bright red on the maps. It was north, on the border of Shinar. The Dark One. Loose upon the world. Light. It made Gawain's own problems insignificant. Bryn finished his letter, sanding the paper, folding it, and reaching for his waxen seal.
It's a little late for calling on people, son.
I know, but I thought you might be up. And so I am.
Bryn dribbled wax onto the letter.
What is it you need?
Advice,
Gowan said, sitting on a stool.
Unless it's about the best way to quarter a group of men, or how to fortify a hilltop, you'll find my advice lacking. But what is it you want to talk about?
Egwene forbade me to protect her.
I'm certain the Amarlin had her reasons,
Bryn said, calmly sealing the letter.
Foolish ones, Gowan said. She has no warder, and there is a killer in the tower.
One of the Forsaken, he thought.
Both true, Bryn said. But what does that have to do with you?
She needs my protection.
Did she ask for your protection?
No.
Indeed. As I recall, she didn't ask you to come with her into the tower either, nor did she ask for you to begin following her about like a hound that has lost its master.
But she needs me, Gowan said.
Interesting. The last time you thought that, you, with my help, upset weeks' worth of her work to reunite the White Tower. Sometimes, son, our help is not needed, no matter how freely offered or how urgent that help may seem.
Gowan folded his arms, unable to lean against the wall, lest he disturb a map showing orchards across the surrounding countryside. One village near Dragonmount was circled 4 times for some reason.
So your advice is to let her remain exposed, perhaps to take a knife in the back?
I haven't given any advice,
Bryn said, leafing through some reports on his desk, his firm face lit by flickering candlelight.
I have only made observations, though I think it curious that you conclude that you should leave her alone.
Bryn, she doesn't make sense.
The corner of Bryn's mouth raised in a wry smile. He lowered his papers, turning to Gowan.
I warned you that my advice would be of little use. I'm not sure if there are answers that will suit you. But let me ask this. What is it you want, Gowan Trakand?
Egwene, he said immediately. I want to be her warder.
Well, which is it?
Gowan frowned.
Do you want Egwene, or do you want to be her warder?
To be her warder, of course, and to marry her. I love her, Bryn.
It seems to me that those are 2 different things, similar but separate. But other than things to do with Egwene, what is it you want?
Nothing, Gowan said. She's everything.
Well, there's your problem.
How is that a problem? I love her.
So you said.
Bryn regarded Gowan, one arm on the table, the other resting on his leg. Gowan resisted the urge to squirm beneath that gaze.
You always were the passionate one, Gowan, like your mother and your sister. Impulsive, never calculating like your brother.
Galad doesn't calculate, Gowan said. He just acts.
No, Bryn said. Perhaps I spoke wrong. Galad may not be calculating, but he isn't impulsive. To be impulsive is to act without careful thought. Galad has given everything a great deal of thought. He's worked out his code of morality that way. He can act quickly and decisively because he's already determined what to do. You act with passion. You don't act because of the way you think, but because of the way you feel. In a rush, with a snap of emotion. That gives you strength. You can act when you need to, then sort through the ramifications later. Your instincts are usually good, just like your mother's were. But because of that, you've never had to face what to do when your instincts lead you in the wrong direction.
Gowan found himself nodding.
But son, Bryn said, leaning forward, a man is more than one drive, one goal.
No woman wants that in a man. It seems to me that men who spend time making something of themselves, rather than professing their devotion, are the ones who get somewhere, both with women and with life itself.
Bryn rubbed his chin.
So if I have advice for you, it's this. Find out who you would be without Egwene, and then figure out how to fit her into that. I think that's what a woman...
You're an expert on women now? A new voice asked.
Gawain turned, surprised, to find Swan Sanchez pushing open the door. Bryn didn't miss a beat.
You've been there listening long enough, Swan, to know that's not what the conversation was about.
Swan snorted, bustling into the room with a pot of tea.
You should be in bed,
she said, ignoring Gawain after a cursory glance.
Very true, Bryn said casually. Oddly, the needs of the land don't submit to my whims.
Maps can be studied in the morning.
And they can be studied at night. And during the afternoon. Every hour I spend could mean leagues of ground defended if Trollocs break through.
Swan sighed loudly, handing him a cup, then pouring the tea, which smelled of cloudberry. It was decidedly odd to see Swan, who, because of her stilling, looked like a woman Gawain's age, mothering the grizzled General Bryn. Swan turned to Gawain as Bryn accepted his drink.
And you, Gawain Trakhand, she said. I've been meaning to speak to you. Giving orders to the Ammerlin, telling her what she should do. Honestly. Men seem to think that women are nothing more than their personal messengers sometimes. You'd dream up all sorts of ridiculous schemes and expect us to somehow carry them out.
She eyed him, not looking like she expected any response other than an ashamed lowering of the eyes. Gawain gave that, and then made a hasty exit to avoid further bullying. He wasn't surprised by anything Bryn had said. The man was nothing if not consistent, and he had repeated the same themes to Gawain before. Think instead of being impulsive. Be deliberate. But he'd spent weeks thinking, his ideas chasing one another in circles like flies trapped in a jar. He'd gotten nowhere. Gawain walked the hallways, noting Chubain's guards posted at regular intervals. He told himself he wasn't climbing to Egwene, he was merely checking on the guards. And yet he soon found himself in a hallway near the Ammerlin's quarters. Just one hallway over. He'd check on her quickly and... Gawain froze. What am I doing? He thought. A lot of his nervousness tonight came from not knowing if Egwene was properly guarded or not. He wouldn't be able to sleep until... No, he told himself forcefully. This time I'll do as she asks. He turned to go. A sound made him hesitate, glancing over his shoulder. Footfalls and clothing rustling. It was too late for novices, but servants might well be delivering late meals. Bryn and Gawain weren't the only ones who kept unusual hours in the White Tower. It came again. So soft, barely audible. Frowning, Gawain slipped off his boots, then sneaked forward to glance around the corner. There was nothing. Egwene's door, inlaid with gold in the shape of Avendisora, sat closed, the hallway empty. Sighing, Gawain shook his head, leaning back against the wall to slip his boots back on. He wished Egwene would at least let Chubain set guards at her room. Leaving it unwatched was... Something moved in the shadow just down from Egwene's doorway. Gawain froze. There wasn't much of a dark patch there, only a shadow a few inches wide made by an alcove. But as he studied that patch, he had trouble keeping his eyes on it. His gaze slid free, like a dollop of butter on a hot turnip. It seemed that the darkness was larger than he had originally thought. Why couldn't he look straight at it? There was a flash of movement, and something spun in the air. Gawain threw himself to the side, and steel struck stone. One boot on, he dropped the other as he pulled his sword free. The knife that had been thrown for his heart skittered across the tiled floor. Gowan peered round the corner, tense. Someone was fleeing down the hallway. Someone wearing all black, a mask over the head. Gowan took off after the person, sword held before him, arms pumping, gait awkward as his unbooted foot hit opposite his booted one. The assassin was extremely fast. Gowan bellowed the alarm, his voice echoing through the silent halls of the tower. Then he cut left. The assassin would have to turn and come up the hallway here to the right. Gowan burst into another hallway, charging on a heading that would cut off the assassin. He skidded around the corner. The hallway was empty. Had the assassin doubled back? Gowan cursed as he ran forward and reached the original hallway at the other end. It was empty. A doorway, perhaps? All would be dead ends. If Gowan waited until help came... No, Gowan thought, spinning. Darkness. Look for darkness. There was a deep patch of it by a doorframe to his left. Far too small to hold anyone, but he had that same sense of disorientation as he looked at it. A person leaped out, swinging a sword for Gowan's head. He whipped his blade into cutting the reeds, knocking aside the attack. The assassin was much shorter than Gowan, so he should have had a strong advantage in reach. Yet the assassin moved with a blurring speed, sword darting at Gowan in a series of thrusts, not using any sword forms Gowan recognized. Gowan fell into twisting the wind, as he was forced to act as if he were surrounded. He barely kept the attacker at bay. He could hear yells in the distance, guards responding to his call. He shouted again. He could sense frustration in the attacker's moves. The assassin had expected to defeat Gowan quickly. Well, Gowan had expected the same, but focusing on the man was very difficult. Gowan's attacks, when he could make them, hit air when they should have landed on flesh. Gowan twisted to the side, raising his blade for boar rushes down the mountain, but that gave the assassin an opening. He flung another knife at Gowan, forcing him to the side. The knife clanged against the wall and the assassin fled down the hallway. Gowan rushed after, but he couldn't keep up. Soon the assassin was far away, darting to the left. That direction led to a series of intersections. Such speed, Gowan thought, stopping, breathing in and out in gasps, hands on knees. It isn't natural. Chubain's guards arrived a moment later, swords at the ready. Gowan pointed.
Assassin, listening at Egwene's door. Went that way.
One ran where he pointed, the other went to raise the general alarm.
Light, Gowan thought. What if I didn't interrupt him listening? What if I interrupted him on his way out?
Gowan dashed to Egwene's door, fatigue evaporating. Sword out, he tested the door. It was unlocked.
Egwene!
He cried, throwing the door open and leaping into the room. There was a sudden explosion of light and a crashing sound. Gowan found himself wrapped up in something strong, invisible cords towing him into the air. His sword fell to the ground, and his mouth filled with an unseen force. And so it was that he found himself hanging from the ceiling, disarmed, struggling, as the Amarlin herself walked from her bedroom. She was alert and fully dressed in a crimson dress trimmed with gold. She did not look pleased. Matt sat beside the inn's hearth, wishing the fire were a little less warm. He could feel its heat through the layers of his ragged jacket and white shirt, matched by a pair of workman's thick trousers. The boots on his feet had good soles, but the sides were worn. He did not wear his hat, and his scarf was pulled up around the bottom half of his face as he leaned back in the mountain oak chair. Elaine still had his medallion. He felt naked without it. He wore a short sword sitting by his chair, but that was mostly for show. A walking staff leaned innocently beside it. He would rather use that or the knives hidden in his coat. But a sword was more visible and would make the footpads who sauntered through the streets of Low Camelin think twice.
I know why you're asking after him, Chet said.
There was a man like Chet in nearly every tavern. Old enough to have seen men like Matt be born, grow up and die, and willing to talk of all those years if you got enough drink in them. Or often if you didn't. The stubble on Chet's long face was dappled silver, and he wore a lopsided cap. His patched coat had once been black, and the red and white insignia on his pocket was too faded to read. It was vaguely militaristic, and one did not usually get scars like the thick, angry one on his cheek and neck from a bar fight.
"Aye," Chet continued. "Many are asking after the leader of that band. Well, this mug of ale is appreciated, so let me give you some advice. You walk like you know which end of that sword means business, but you'd be a fool to challenge that one. Prince of Ravens, Lord of Luck. He faced old death himself and diced for his future, he did. Ain't never lost a fight."
Matt said nothing. He leaned back in his chair. This was his fourth tavern this night, and in three of them he had been able to find rumors about Matram Cawthon. Barely a lick of truth to them. Blood and bloody ashes. Oh, sure, there were tales of other people, too. Most about Rand, each one making the colors swirl when he heard them. Tyr had fallen to the Seanchan. No, Ilion. No, Rand had defeated them all and was fighting the last battle right now.
No.
He visited women in their sleep, getting them with child.
No, that was the Dark One.
No, Matt was the Dark One. Bloody stories. They were supposed to leave Matt alone. Some he could trace back to the band, like the story of a city full of the dead awakening. But many of the people claimed that the stories had come from their uncle or cousin or nephew. Matt flicked Chet a copper. The man tipped his hat politely and went to get himself another drink. Matt did not feel like drinking. He had a suspicion that those pictures of him were part of why the stories were spreading so quickly. In the last tavern he had visited, someone had actually pulled out a copy of the sketch, folded and wrinkled, and shown it to him. Nobody had recognized him so far, though. The hearth fire continued to crackle. Lokamlin was growing, and enterprising men had realized that providing rooms and drinks for the transients could make a healthy profit. So shanties had started to become taverns, and those had begun to grow into full inns. Wood was in high demand, and many of the mercenary bands had taken to woodcutting. Some worked honestly, paying the queen's levy for claims. Others worked less legally. There had already been hangings for it. Who would have thought? Men hanging for poaching trees. What next? Men hanging for stealing dirt? Lokamlin had changed drastically. Roads springing up, buildings being enlarged. A few years and Lokamlin would be a city itself. They'd have to build another wall to close it in. The room smelled of dirt and sweat, but no more so than other taverns. Spills were quickly cleaned up, and the serving girls looked eager to have work. One in particular gave him a quiet smile, refilling his mug and showing some ankle. Matt made sure to remember her. She would be good for Telmanis. Matt lifted up his scarf enough to drink. He felt like a fool wearing the scarf this way. But it was too hot for a hooded cloak, and the beard had been torture. Even with the scarf on his face, he did not stand out too much in Lokamlin. He was not the only tough walking around with his face obscured. He explained that he had a bad scar he wanted to cover. Others assumed he had a bounty on his head. Both were actually true, unfortunately. He sat for a time staring into the dancing flames of the hearth. Chet's warning caused an uncomfortable pit to open in Matt's stomach. The greater his reputation grew, the more likely he would be challenged. There would be great notoriety in killing the Prince of the Ravens. Where had they gotten that name? Blood and bloody ashes. A figure joined him at the fire. Lanky and bony, Noel looked like a scarecrow who had dusted himself off and decided to go to town. Despite his white hair and leathery face, Noel was as spry as men half his age, when he was handling a weapon, anyway. Other times, he seemed as clumsy as a mule in a dining parlor.
"You're quite the notable man,"
Noel said to Matt, holding out his palms to the fire.
"When you stumbled across me in Ebu Dar, I had no idea what illustrious company I'd find myself in. Give this a few more months, and you'll be more famous than Jane Farstrider."
Matt hunkered down farther into his chair.
"Men always think it would be grand to be known in every tavern in every city,"
Matt said softly.
but burn me if it isn't just a headache.
What do you know of it?
Jane complained about it,
Noel said softly. Matt grunted. Tom arrived next. He was dressed as a merchant's servant, wearing a blue outfit that was not too fine, but also not in disrepair. He was claiming to have come to Lokamlin to determine whether his master would be well advised to put a shop front here. Tom pulled off the disguise with aplomb, waxing his mustache to points and speaking with a faint Mirandian accent. Matt had offered to come up with a backstory for his act, but Tom had coughed and said that he already had one worked out. Flaming liar of a gleeman. Tom pulled up a chair, seating himself delicately, as if he were a servant who thought highly of himself.
Ah, what a waste of my time this was. My master insists that I associate with such rabble as this. And here I find the worst of the lot.
Noel chuckled softly.
If only,
Tom said dramatically,
I had been instead sent to the camp of the majestic, amazing, indestructible, famous Matrim Cawthon. Then I would certainly have...
Burn me, Tom, Matt said. Let a man suffer in peace.
Tom laughed, waving over the serving girl and buying drinks for the three of them. He gave her an extra coin and quietly asked her to keep casual ears from getting too close to the hearth.
Are you sure you want to meet here?
Noel asked.
It'll do, Matt said.
He did not want to be seen back in camp, lest the Golem look there for him.
All right, then,
Noel said.
We know where the tower is, and can get there, assuming Matt procures us a gateway.
I will, Matt said.
I haven't been able to find anyone who has gone inside,
Noel continued.
Some say it's haunted,
Tom said, taking a slurp from his mug.
Others say it's a relic from the Age of Legends. The sides are said to be of smooth steel without an opening. I did find a captain's widow's younger son, who once heard a story of someone who found great treasures in the tower. He didn't say how the lad had gotten in, though.
We know how to get in, Matt said.
Olver's story?
Noel asked skeptically.
It's the best we have, Matt said. Look, the game and the rhyme are about the Aelfin and Eelfin. People knew about them once. Those bloody archways are proof of that. So they left the game and the rhyme as warning.
That game can't be won, Matt,
Noel said, rubbing his leathery chin.
And that's the point of it. You need to cheat.
But maybe we should try a deal,
Tom said, playing with the waxed tip of a mustache.
They did give you answers to your questions.
Bloody frustrating ones, Matt said.
He had not wanted to tell Tom and Noel about his questions. He still had not told them what he had asked.
But they did answer,
Tom said.
It sounds like they had some kind of deal with the Aes Sedai. If we knew what it was the Aes Sedai had that the snakes and foxes wanted, the reason they were willing to bargain, then maybe we could trade it to them for Moraine.
If she's still alive,
Noel said grimly.
She is, Tom said, staring straight ahead. Light send it. She has to be alive.
We know what they want, Matt glanced at those flames.
What?
Noel asked.
Us, Matt replied. Look, they can see what's going to happen. They did it to me, they did it to Moraine, if that letter is any clue. They knew she would leave a letter for you, Tom. They knew it. And they still answered her questions.
Maybe they had to, Tom said.
Yes, but they don't have to answer straightforwardly, Matt said. They didn't with me. They answered knowing she would come back to them. And they gave me what they did, knowing I'd get pulled back too. They want me, they want us.
You don't know that for certain, Matt.
Tom set his mug of ale on the floor between his feet and got out his pipe. To Matt's right, men cheered a dice game.
They can answer questions, but that doesn't mean they know everything. Could be like Aes Sedai foretellings.
Matt shook his head. The creatures put memories into his head. He figured they were the memories of people who had touched the tower or been into it. The Aelfin and the Aelfin had those memories, and Burnham, they probably had his, too. Could they watch him? See through his eyes? He wished again for his medallion, though it would do no good against them. They were not Aes Sedai. They would not use channeling.
They do know things, Tom, Matt said. They're watching. We won't surprise them.
Makes them hard to defeat, then,
Tom said, lighting a tinder twig with the fire, then using it to light his pipe.
We can't win.
Unless we break the rules, Matt repeated.
But they'll know what we're doing, Tom said, if what you say is true. So we should trade with them.
And what did Moraine say, Tom? Matt said. In that letter you read every night.
Tom puffed on his pipe, raising an absent hand to his breast pocket where he kept the letter.
She said to remember what we knew of the game.
She knows there's no way to win when dealing with them, Matt said. No trades, Tom. No bargains. We go in fighting and we don't leave until we have her.
Tom hesitated for a moment, then nodded, his pipe beginning to puff.
Courage to strengthen,
Noel said.
Well, we have enough of that, with Matt's luck.
You don't have to be part of this, you know, Noel, Matt said. You have no reason to risk yourself on this.
I'm going,
Noel said.
I've seen a lot of places. Most places, actually. But never this one.
He hesitated.
It's something I need to do, and that's the end of it.
Very well, Matt said.
Fire to blind,
Noel said.
What do we have?
Lanterns and torches, Matt said, knocking his foot against the sack beside his chair. And some of those fire sticks from Aludra, so we can light them. A few surprises from her, too.
Fireworks?
Noel asked. And a few of those exploding cylinders we used against the Shan Chan. She calls them roar sticks. Tom whistled.
She let you have some?
Two. When I presented her with Elaine's agreement, she was ready to let me have almost anything I asked for.
Matt grimaced.
She wanted to come along to light them. Herself. Burn me, but that was a tough argument to end. But we've got a whole lot of night flowers.
He tapped the sack beside his chair with the edge of his foot.
You brought them? Tom asked.
I wanted to keep them close, Matt said. And she only gave them to me today. They're not going to explode by accident, Tom. That doesn't happen very often.
We'll at least move them back from the hearth, Tom said.
He glanced at his pipe and cursed, then scooted his chair a few inches from Matt.
Next,
Noel said.
Music to days.
I got us a variety, Tom said. I'll bring my harp and flute, but I found us some hand drums and hand cymbals. They can be strapped to the side of your leg and hit with one hand. I also bought an extra flute.
He eyed Matt.
A simple one, designed for those with thick, slow fingers.
Matt snorted.
And finally, iron to bind,
Noel said, sliding forward a pack of his own. It clinked faintly as he untied the top, the contents reflecting the deep orange hearthlight.
A set of throwing knives for each of us and two short swords, each of pure iron, no steel. I got us some chains, too, and a band of iron to clip around the butt of Matt's spear. It might throw the weight off, though.
I'll take it, Matt said.
Noel did up his pack again, and the three of them sat before the hearth for a time. In a way, these things they'd gathered were an illusion, a way to reassure themselves that they were doing something to prepare. But Matt remembered those twisted places beyond the gateways, the angles that were not right, the unnatural landscape, the sinuous creatures called snakes and foxes because they defied standard description. That place was another world. The preparations he did with Tom and Noel might help, but they might also be useless. There was no telling until they stepped into that tower. It felt like not knowing if you had the right antidote until after the snake's teeth were already clamped down on your arm. Eventually, he bade the other two a good night. Noel wanted to head back to the band's camp, which was now only a 10-minute ride from the city. Tom agreed to go with him, and they took Matt's pack full of night flowers, though both men looked as if they would rather be carrying a sack full of spiders. Matt belted his sword on over his coat, took up his staff, then headed back toward his inn. He did not go directly there, though, and instead found himself trailing through the alleys and streets. Shanties and tents had sprung up beside solid buildings, as the city outside the city spread along the walls like mold growing on a loaf of bread. The sky was dark, but the night was still busy, people calling from within the lit doorways of inns. Matt made sure the short sword was visible. There were many who would think to exploit a lone wanderer at night, particularly outside the city walls, where the arm of the law was a little on the flabby side. The air smelled of impending rain, but it often did these days. He wished it would go on in storm or bloody clear up. It felt as if the air were holding its breath, waiting for something. A blow that never fell, a bell that never rang, a set of dice that never stopped spinning, just like the ones that thundered in his head. He felt at the letter from Varen in his pocket. Would the dice stop if he opened it? Maybe it was about the golem. If he did not retrieve his medallion from Elaine soon, the thing was likely to find him and rip his insides out. Bloody ashes. He felt like going drinking, forgetting who he was, and who people thought he was, for a while. But if he got drunk, he was likely to let his face show by accident, perhaps begin to talk about who he really was. You could never tell what a man would do when he was drunk, even if that man was your own self. He made his way through the city gates and into the new city. The air began to mist with something that was not quite rain, as if the sky had listened to his rant and had decided to allow a little sneeze to spray down on him. Wonderful, he thought. Bloody wonderful. The paving stones soon grew wet from the not rain, and the street lamps glowed with balls of vaporous haze. Matt hunkered down, scarf still covering his face as if he were a bloody eyelman. Had he not been too hot only a little bit ago? He was as eager as Tom to move on and find Moraine. She had made a mess of his life, but Matt supposed he owed her for that. Better to live in this mess than be trapped back in the Two Rivers, living a boring life without realizing how boring it was. Matt was not like Perrin, who had mooned over leaving the Two Rivers before they had even gotten to Barillon. An image of Perrin flashed in his head, and Matt banished it. And what of Rand? Matt saw him sitting on a fine chair, staring down at the ground in front of himself in a dark room, a single lamp flickering. He looked worn and exhausted, his eyes wide, his expression grim. Matt shook his head to dispel that image as well. Poor Rand. The man probably thought he was a bloody black ferret or something by now, gnawing on pine cones. But it was likely a black ferret that wanted to live back in the Two Rivers. No, Matt did not want to go back. There was no Tuon back in the Two Rivers. Light. Well, he would have to figure out what to do with Tuon. But he did not want to be rid of her. If she were still with him, he would let her call him Toy without complaining. Well, not much, anyway. Moraine first. He wished he knew more about the Aelfin and Eelfin and their bloody tower. Nobody knew about it. Nobody spoke more than legends. Nobody had anything useful to say. Nobody but Birgitta. Matt stopped in the street. Birgitta. She had been the one to tell Ulver how to get into the tower. How had she known? Cursing himself for a fool, he turned toward the inner city. The streets were emptying of the traffic that had burdened them before the almost rain began. Soon Matt felt he had the whole city to himself. Even the cutpurses and beggars withdrew. For some reason, that put him on edge more than being stared at. It was not natural. Someone should have tried at least to bloody shadow him to see if he was worth picking off. Once again, he longed for his medallion. He had been an idiot to give that away. Better to have cut off his own bloody hand and offered that to Elaine as payment. Was the golem there, in that darkness, somewhere? There should have been toughs on the street. Cities were full of them. That was practically one of the bloody requirements for a city. A town hall, a few inns and a tavern, and several blunt-faced fellows whose only desire was to pound you into the mud and spend your coin on drink and women. He passed a courtyard and headed through the Mason's Gate into the inner city, the white archway almost seeming to glow, rain-slick in the phantom light of the moon above. Matt's quarterstaff knocked against the paving stones. The guard gates were huddled and quiet in their cloaks, like statues, not men at all. The entire place felt like a tomb. A ways past the gate, he passed an alleyway and then hesitated. He thought he could see a group of shadowy forms inside. Tall buildings rose on either side, grand Ogier masonwork. A grunt sounded from inside the alleyway. "A robbery?" Matt said with relief. A hulking figure looked back out of the alleyway. Moonlight revealed a fellow with dark eyes and a long cloak. He seemed stunned to find Matt standing there. He pointed with a thick-fingered hand, and three of his companions made for Matt. Matt relaxed, wiping his brow free of rainwater. So there were footpads out this night. What a relief. He had been jumping at nothing. A thug swung his cudgel at Matt. Matt had worn the short sword on the right side intentionally. The thug took the bait, assuming that Matt would move to draw the weapon. Instead, Matt brought up the quarterstaff swiftly, snapping the butt against the man's leg. The footpad stumbled, and Matt swung into the man's head. The drizzle, which was nearly a proper rain by now, sprayed off the cut purse as he fell, tripping one of his companions. Matt stepped back and slammed the top of the quarterstaff down on the head of the tripping thug. He went down on top of his companion. The third man looked back toward his leader, who held to the collar of a gangly man Matt could barely make out in the shadows. Matt took the opportunity to leap over the small pile of unconscious thugs, swinging at the third man. The footpad brought his cudgel up to protect his head, so Matt slammed his quarterstaff into the man's foot. He then swung the quarterstaff, knocking aside the third man's weak parry, then dropped him with a blow to the face. Matt casually flipped a knife toward the leader of the gang, who was charging forward. The leader gurgled, stumbled in the drizzle, clawing at the knife in his neck. The others Matt would leave unconscious. Poor fools. Maybe they would take this warning and reform. Matt stepped to the side as the leader stumbled past, then finally collapsed on top of his three companions. Matt kicked him over, pulled out the knife, then cleaned it. Finally, he glanced at the victim of the robbery.
"Sure am glad to see you," Matt said.
You are?
The man asked.
"Sure am," Matt said, standing up straight. "I thought the thieves were not out tonight. A city without cut purses? Well, that's like a field without weeds. And if there were no weeds, what would you need a farmer for? Bloody inhospitable, I tell you."
The rescued man stumbled forward on shaky feet. He seemed confused by what Matt had said, but he scrambled up, taking Matt's hand.
"Thank you."
The man had a nasal voice.
"Thank you so, so much."
In the faint moonlight, Matt could barely make out a wide face with buck teeth atop an awkwardly thin body. Matt shrugged, setting aside his staff and unwinding his scarf, which was getting sodden and beginning to wring it free.
"I'd stay away from traveling by yourself at night if I were you, friend."
The man squinted in the darkness.
"You!"
he said, voice nearly a squeak. Matt groaned.
"Blood and bloody ashes. Can't I go anywhere without—"
He cut off as the man lunged, a dagger flashing in the faint moonlight. Matt cursed and snapped his scarf in front of him. The dagger hit the cloth instead of Matt's gut, and Matt quickly twisted his hands, tying the assassin's dagger in lengths of cloth. The man yelped, and Matt released the scarf and pulled out a pair of knives, one in each hand, releasing them by reflex. They took the assassin in the eyes, one in each eye. light. Matt had not been aiming for the eyes. The man collapsed to the wet paving stones. Matt stood breathing in and out.
Mother's milk in a cup! Mother's bloody milk!
He grabbed his quarterstaff, glancing about him, but the gloomy street was empty.
I rescued you! I rescued you and you try to stab me?
Matt knelt down beside the corpse. Then, grimly certain what he would find, he fished in the man's pouch. He came out with a couple of coins, gold coins, and a folded-up piece of paper. Moonlight revealed Matt's face on it. He crinkled the paper and shoved it in his pocket. One in each bloody eye. Better than the man deserved. Matt retied his scarf, grabbed his knives, then walked out onto the street, wishing he had left the assassin to his fate.
Birgitta folded her arms, leaning against a marble pillar, and watching as Elaine sat enjoying an evening presentation of players. Groups like this, acting out stories, had become very popular in Kyrian, and were now trying to achieve the same success in Andor. One of the palace halls, where bards performed, had been adapted to allow the players to act out their stories. Birgitta shook her head. What was the good of acting out fake stories? Why not go live a few stories of your own? Besides, she'd prefer a bard any day. Hopefully this fashion of seeing players would die quickly. This particular story was a retelling of the tragic marriage and death of the princess Walishen, slain by beasts of the shadow. Birgitta was familiar with the ballad that the players had adapted to form their story. In fact, they sang parts of it during the performance. It was remarkable how little that song had changed over the years. Some different names, a few different notes, but the same overall. Much like her own lives, repeated over and over but with little variations. Sometimes she was a soldier. Sometimes she was a forest woman with no formal military training. She'd been a general once or twice, unfortunately. She'd rather leave that particular job for someone else. She'd been a guard, a noble thief, a lady, a peasant, a killer, and a savior, but she had never before been a warder. The unfamiliarity didn't bother her. In most of her lives, she had no knowledge of what had come before. What she could draw from her previous lives now was a boon, yes, but she had no right to those memories. That didn't stop her heart from twisting each time one of those memories faded. Light. If she couldn't be with Gaidal this time around, couldn't she at least remember him? It was as if the pattern didn't know what to do with her. She'd been forced into this life, shoving other threads aside, taking an unexpected place. The pattern was trying to weave her in. What would happen when all of the memories faded? Would she remember waking up as an adult with no history? The thought terrified her as no battlefield ever had. She nodded to one of her guardswomen, Kyla Bent, who passed by the back row of the palace theater and saluted. Well? Birgitta asked, stepping around the corner to speak with Kyla. Nothing to report, Kyla said. All is well? She was a lanky, fire-haired woman, and had taken very easily to wearing the trousers and coat of a guardswoman. Or all is as well as it could be while having to suffer through the death of Princess Walishen. Stop complaining, Birgitta said, suppressing a wince as the diva, so the players called her, began a particularly shrill aria. So they called a song by herself. Why did the players need so many new names for things? You could be out patrolling in the rain. I could? Kyla asked, sounding eager. Why didn't you say so sooner? Maybe I'll get struck by lightning. That might be preferable. Birgitta snorted. Get back to your rounds. Kyla saluted and left. Birgitta turned back into the theater, leaning against the pillar. Perhaps she should have brought some wax to stuff in her ears. She glanced over at Elaine. The queen sat with a calm demeanor, watching the play. At times, Birgitta felt more like a nursemaid than a bodyguard. How did you protect a woman who seemed at times so determined to see herself dead? And yet Elaine was also so very capable. Like tonight, she'd somehow convinced her most bitter rival to attend this play. That was Elorian sitting over in the eastern row. The woman's last parting from the palace had been so bitter that Birgitta hadn't expected her to return unless she was in chains. Yet here she was. It whispered of a political maneuver by Elaine that was 13 steps more subtle than Birgitta had a mind for. She shook her head. Elaine was a queen. Volatility and all. She'd be good for Andor. Assuming Birgitta could keep that golden-haired head from being lopped off its neck. After some time suffering through the singing, Kyla approached again. Birgitta stood up straight, curious at the woman's quick pace. What? She asked quietly. You looked bored, Kyla whispered, so I thought I'd bring this to you. Disturbance at the Plum Gate. That was the southeastern entrance to the palace grounds. Someone tried to sneak through. Another beggar looking for scraps? Or a spy for one of the lordlings hoping to listen in? I don't know, Kyla said. I heard the news third hand from Callison as we passed on patrol. He said the guardsmen have the intruder in custody at the gate. Birgitta glanced to the side. It looked like another solo was about to begin. You have command here. Hold this post and take reports. I'll go stretch my legs and check on this disturbance. Bring me some wax for my ears when you come back, would you? Birgitta chuckled, leaving the theater and stepping into a white and red palace hallway. Though she had guardswomen and men with extra bows at the hallways, Birgitta herself carried a sword, for an assassination attempt would most likely turn to close quarters fighting. Birgitta trotted down the hallway, glancing out a window when she passed. The sky leaked a deep drizzle. Utterly dreary. Gaidal would have liked this weather. He loved the rain. On occasion, she joked that drizzle suited his face better, making him less likely to frighten children. Liked, but she missed that man. The most direct route to the Plum Gate took her through the servants' quarters. In many palaces, this would have meant entering a section of the building that was more drab, meant for less important people. But this building had been Ogier built, and they had particular views about such things. The marble stonework here was as grand as it was elsewhere, with tiled mosaics of red and white. The rooms, while small by royal standards, were each large enough to hold an entire family. Birgitta generally preferred to take her meals in the servants' large, open dining hall. Four separate hearths crackled here in defiance of the dreary night, and off-duty servants and guards laughed and chatted. Some said you could judge a monarch by the way he treated those who served him. If that were the case, then the Andoran palace had been designed in a way to encourage the best in its queens. Birgitta reluctantly passed by the inviting scents of food and instead pushed her way out into the cold summer storm. The chill wasn't biting, just uncomfortable. She pulled up the hood of her cloak and crossed the slick paving down to the Plum Gate. The gatehouse was alight with an orange glow, and the guardsmen on watch stood outside in wet cloaks, halberds held to the side. Birgitta marched up to the gatehouse, water streaming from the lip of her hood, then pounded on the thick oak door. It opened, revealing the bald-headed, mustached face of Renald Macer, sergeant on duty. A stout man, he had wide hands and a calm temperament. She always thought he should be in a shop somewhere making shoes, but the guard took all types, and dependability was often more important than skill with the sword. "Captain General," he exclaimed. "What are you doing here?" "Getting rained on," she snapped. "Oh my." He stepped back, making way for her to enter the gatehouse. It had a single crowded room. The soldiers were on storm shift, meaning twice as many men would work the gate as usual, but they would only have to stand outside an hour before rotating with the men warming inside the gatehouse. Three guards sat around a table, throwing dice into a dicing box, while an open-fronted iron stove consumed logs and warmed tea. Dicing with the four soldiers was a wiry man with a black scarf wrapped around the bottom of his face. His clothing was scruffy, his head topped by a mop of wet brown hair sticking out in all directions. Brown eyes glanced at Birgitta over the top of the scarf, and the man sank down a little in his seat. Birgitta took off her cloak and shook it free of rainwater.
"This is your intruder, I assume."
"Why, yes," the sergeant said. "How did you hear about that?"
She eyed the intruder.
"He tried to sneak onto the palace grounds? And now you're dicing with him?"
The sergeant and the other men looked sheepish.
"Well, my lady..."
"I'm no lady."
"Not this time, at least."
"I work for a living."
Yes," Macer continued. "Well, he gave up his sword readily, and he doesn't seem that dangerous. Just another beggar wanting scraps from the kitchens. Right nice fellow. Thought we'd get him warm before sending him out into that weather again."
"A beggar," she said. "With a sword?"
Sergeant Macer scratched his head.
"I guess that is kind of odd."
"You could charm the helmet off a general on a battlefield, couldn't you, Matt?" she said.
"Matt?"
the man asked in a familiar voice.
"I don't know what you mean, my good woman. My name is Gerard, a simple beggar who has a quite interesting past, if you care to listen to it."
She eyed him with a firm gaze.
"Oh, bloody ashes, Birgitta," he complained, taking off the scarf. "I only wanted to get warm for a spell."
"And win the coin off my men."
"A friendly game never hurt a man," Matt said.
"Unless it was against you.
Look, why are you sneaking into the palace?"
"It took too much bloody work to get in last time," Matt said, sitting back in his chair. "Thought I might pass that up this time."
Sergeant Macer glanced at Birgitta.
"You know this man?"
"Unfortunately," she said. "You can release him to my custody, Sergeant. I'll see that Master Cawthon is properly taken care of."
"Master Cawthon?" one of the men said. "You mean the Raven Prince?"
"Oh, for bloody," Matt said as he stood and picked up his walking staff.
"Thanks," he said dryly to Birgitta, throwing on his coat.
She put her coat back on, then pushed open the door as one of the guards handed Matt his sword, belt still attached. Since when had Matt carried a short sword? Probably a decoy away from the quarterstaff. The two stepped out into the rain as Matt tied on the belt.
"Raven Prince?" she asked.
"I don't want to talk about it."
"Why not?"
"Because I'm getting too bloody famous for my own good, that's why."
"Wait until it tracks you across generations," she said, glancing up at the sky, blinking as a raindrop hit her square in the eye.
"Come on, let's go grab a drink," Matt said, walking toward the gate.
"Wait," she said. "Don't you want to go see Elaine?"
"Elaine?" Matt said. "Blood and ashes, Birgitta. I'm here to talk to you. Why do you think I let those guards catch me? You want a drink or not?"
She hesitated, then shrugged. By putting Kyla on duty in her place, Birgitta had officially gone on break. She knew a fairly decent tavern only two streets from the palace.
"All right," she said, waving to the guards and leading Matt onto the rainy street. "But I'll need to have milk or tea instead of ale." We aren't sure if her warder drinking would be bad for the babies or not.
She smiled, thinking of a drunk Elaine trying to talk to her allies after the play.
"Though if I make her tipsy, it might be good revenge for some of the things she's done to me." I don't know why you let her bond you in the first place, Matt said. The street was nearly empty around them, though the tavern up ahead looked inviting, its yellow light spilling into the street. I didn't have a say in the matter, she said, but I don't regret it. Did you really sneak into the palace to meet with me? Matt shrugged. I have some questions. About what? He replaced that ridiculous scarf, which she noticed had a rip in the middle. You know, he said. Things. Matt was one of the few who knew who she really was. He couldn't mean... No, she said, turning. I don't want to talk about it. Bloody ashes, Birgitta! I need your information. Come on, for an old friend. We agreed to keep each other's secrets. And I'm not out blabbing yours, Matt said quickly. But see, there's this issue. What issue? The Tower of Genji. That's not an issue, she said. You stay away from it. I can't. Of course you can. It's a flaming building, Matt. It can't exactly chase you down. Very amusing. Look, will you at least hear me out over a mug of, milk? I'll buy. She stopped for a moment, then she sighed. Bloody right you'll buy, she muttered, waving him onward. They entered the inn, known as the Grand Hike, which was crowded beyond usual because of the rain. The innkeeper was a friend of Birgitta's, however, and he had the bouncer toss out a drunkard sleeping in one of the booths to make room for her. She tossed him a coin in thanks, and he nodded his ugly head to her. He was missing several teeth, one eye, and most of his hair. Best-looking man in the place. Birgitta held up two fingers to order drinks. He knew that she took milk these days, and she waved Matt to the booth. I don't rightly think I've ever seen an uglier man than that innkeeper, Matt said as they sat. You haven't been alive long enough, she said, leaning back against the wall and putting her booted feet up on the table. There was just room enough for her to do so, sitting on the bench of the booth, lengthwise. If old Snert were a few years younger, and if someone thought to break his nose in a few places, I might consider him. He's got a fine chest. Nice and full of curly hair to get your fingers in. Matt grinned. Have I ever mentioned how odd it is to go drinking with a woman who talks about men like that? She shrugged. Genji. Why in the name of Normad's ears are you wanting to go there? Whose ears? Matt asked. Answer me. Matt sighed, then absently accepted his mug as the serving girl delivered it. Uncharacteristically, he didn't slap her backside, though he did give her a good leer as she walked away. The bloody snakes and foxes have a friend of mine, he said, lowering his scarf and taking a pull on his drink. Leave him. You can't save him, Matt. If he was foolish enough to go into their realm, he deserves what he got. It's a woman, Matt said. Ah, Birgitta thought. Bloody fool. Heroic, but still a fool. I can't leave her, Matt continued. I owe her. Besides, a good friend of mine is going in whether I want him to or not. I have to help. Then they'll have all three of you, Birgitta said. Look, if you go in through the portals, then you're locked into the treaties. They protect you to an extent, but they also restrict you. You'll never get anywhere useful after entering by one of the archways. And if you go in the other way? Matt asked. You told Olver how to open the tower. Because I was telling him a bedtime story. Light, I never thought one of you sap for brains would actually try to get in. But if we go in that way, can we find her? Maybe, Birgitta said. But you won't. The treaties won't be in effect, so the Aelfin and Eelfin can draw blood. Normally, you only have to worry about tricks with pits or ropes, since they can't... She trailed off, glancing at him. How did you get hanged, anyway? He flushed, looking down into his drink. They should post a flaming explanation on those archways. Step through here and they can bloody hang you. And they will, idiot. Birgitta snorted. They'd talked about the memories he had. She should have put it together. If you go in the other way, they'll probably try that as well. Shedding blood in their kingdom can have strange effects. They'll try to break your bones with a fall, or drug you to sleep. And they will win, Matt. It's their world. And if we cheat? Matt asked. Iron? Music? Fire? That's not cheating. That's being smart. Everyone with half a wit who enters through the tower carries those things. But only 1 out of 1,000 makes it back out, Matt. He hesitated, then fished a small handful of coins out of his pocket. What do you think the odds are that if I toss these into the air, they will all come up heads? 1 in 1,000? Matt. He tossed them above the table. They came down in a spray, hitting the tabletop. Not a single one of them bounced or rolled from the table onto the floor. Matt didn't look down at the coins. He met her eyes as they all rolled and vibrated to a stop. She glanced at them. 2 dozen coins. Each had landed face up. 1 in 1,000 is good odds, he said. For me. Bloody ashes! You're as bad as Elaine. Don't you see? All it takes is 1 wrong throw. Even you miss once in a while. I'll take the chance. Burn me, Birgitta. I know it's stupid, but I'm doing it. How do you know so much about the tower, anyway? You've been into it, haven't you? I have, she admitted. Matt looked smug. Well, you got back out. How'd you manage it? She hesitated, then finally took up her mug of milk. That legend didn't survive, I'm assuming. I don't know it, Matt said. I went in to ask them to save the life of my love, she said. It came after the Battle of La Pointe Hills, where we led the Buchaner Rebellion. Gaidul was wounded horribly, a blow to the head that made him unable to think straight. He forgot who I was some of the time. It tore my heart, so I took him to the tower to be healed. And how'd you get out? Matt asked. How'd you fool them? I didn't, Birgitta said softly. Matt froze. The eel fin never healed him, she continued. They killed us both. I didn't survive, Matt. That is the end of that particular legend. He fell silent. Oh, he finally said. Well, that's kind of a sad story, then. They can't all end in victory. Gaidul and I don't deal well with happy endings anyway. Better for us to burn out in glory. She grimaced, remembering one incarnation when she and he had been forced to grow old together peacefully. Most boring life she'd ever known. Though at the time, ignorant of her grander part in the pattern, she'd been happy with it. Well, I'm still going, Matt said. She sighed. I can't go with you, Matt. Not and leave Elaine. She has a death wish the size of your ego, and I mean to see she survives. I don't expect you to go, Matt said quickly. Burn me, that's not what I'm asking. And, he frowned. A death what, the size of my what? Never mind, she said, drinking her milk. She had a soft spot for milk, though she didn't tell people of it. Of course she'd be happy when she could drink again. She missed old Snert's yeasty drinks. She liked ugly beer as much as she liked ugly men. I came to you because I need help, Matt said. What more is there to say? You're taking iron, fire, and music. Iron will hurt them, ward them, and hold them. Fire will scare them and kill them. Music will entrance them. but you'll find that both fire and music grow less and less effective the longer you use them. The tower isn't a place, it's a portal. A kind of gate to the crossroads between their realms. You'll find both of them there. Eelfin snakes and Eelfin foxes. Assuming they're working together currently. They have a strange relationship. But what do they want? Matt asked. From us, I mean, why do they care? Emotion, Birgitta said. That's why they feed portals into our world. That's why they entice us in. They feed off what we feel. They like Aes Sedai in particular for some reason. Perhaps those with the One Power taste like a strong ale. Matt shivered visibly. The inside will be confusing, Birgitta said. Getting anywhere specific in there is difficult. Going in through the tower instead of the archways put me in danger, but I knew that if I could reach that grand hall, I'd be able to make a deal. You don't get anything free if you go in the tower, by the way. They'll ask for something. Something dear to you. Anyway, I figured out a method to find the grand hall. Iron dust left behind me in the intersections where I'd passed so that I knew which ways I'd gone before. They couldn't touch it, you see, and... Are you sure you've never heard this story? Matt shook his head. It used to be popular around these parts, she said, frowning. 100 years ago or so. You sound offended. It was a good story, she said. If I survive, I'll have Tom compose a bloody ballad about it, Birgitta. Tell me about the dust. Did your plan work? She shook her head. I still got lost. I don't know if they blew away the dust somehow, or if the place is so huge that I never repeated myself. I ended up cornered, my fire going out, my lyre broken, my bowstring snapped, Geidel unconscious behind me. He could walk some of the days in there, but was too dizzy on others, so I pulled him on the litter I'd brought. Some of the days? Matt said. How long were you in there? I had provisions for 2 months, Birgitta said, grimacing. Don't know how long we lasted after those ran out. Bloody ashes, Matt said, then took a long swig on his ale. I told you not to go in, Birgitta said. Assuming you do reach your friend, you'll never get back out. You can wander for weeks in that place and never turn right or left. Keep going straight, passing hallway after hallway all the same. The grand hall could be minutes away if you knew which direction to take. But you'll keep missing it. Matt stared into his mug, perhaps wishing he'd ordered something more potent. You reconsidering? She asked. No, he said. But when we get out, Moiraine better bloody appreciate this. 2 months? He frowned. Wait, if you both died in there, how did the story get out? She shrugged. Never did find out. Perhaps one of the Aes Sedai used their questions to ask. Everyone knew I'd gone in. I was called Jethari Moondancer then. You sure you've never heard the story? He shook his head again. She sighed, settling back. Well, not every one of the tales about her could live on forever, but she'd thought that one would stand for a few more generations. She raised her mug to drink the last of her milk. The mug never got there. She froze when she felt a jolt of emotion from Elaine. Anger, fury, pain. Birgitta slammed the mug down on the table, then threw coins down and stood up, cursing. What? Matt said, on his feet in an eye blink. Elaine, in trouble. Again, she's hurt. Bloody ashes, Matt snapped, grabbing his coat and staff as they ran for the exit.